This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
In fact, rarity is common. So the difference between an endangered and a rare species is, so a species can be rare if it has a very narrow range or it has a very low population density, but it could be distributed over a very large area. But endangered species typically are those that have low numbers, are usually only in a very few places, and are often threatened by some major human activity, anything from loss of habitat to flooding to fire.
Well, you talk in your book about, and you basically go around the world chasing after all kinds of rarities, but some of these rarities, they're rare and has nothing to do at all with human interaction. They're not close to urbanization or farming or any of the other hazards of human activity. So why are certain species more rare than other species?
Well, let's take the easiest example. So top predators. Whether we're talking about tigers in Nepal, as I do in my book, or great white sharks, they're probably about the same number of tigers on Earth as there are great white sharks, probably no more than 3,500 right now in the wild. And wherever they occur at very low densities. And the reason is that it simply takes a lot of prey items to be able to support a single top predator. So that's the easy one, where you have a species is at the top of the food pyramid, and you just simply can't have a lot of them in a given area. On top of that, tigers are extremely territorial, and the reason being is that they have to defend large areas where there's enough food to be able to produce their cubs. We know that it takes about 52 elk-sized deer eaten a year, so about one a week, to fuel a breeding female tiger. So it's really basically a matter of energetics.
So after we start with the the top of the food chain with the the primary predators, there are other species that also tend to be very rare, even though they have no contact with humans. And what's the reason for that?
So that's the other extreme, is the species with very narrow ranges. And that's much more typical of rarity, because we don't have that many top predators around on the planet. Thank goodness. They'd be hunting us as biologists as we're out there in the field. We have a lot of species, for example, a lot of plants that are very restricted because of the type of soil substrate that you find them on. You know, a famous botanist once said that really botany is all about geology, because a lot of plants are limited by where they can make a living, where they can be found, by the kind of soil type. And so when you have unusual soils, soils with like a lot of heavy metals in them, or sandstone, or limestone, or quartz, you tend to have plants with very narrow distributions. So what it means is that you have a lot of species. So basically, most species on Earth are specialists of one kind or another, but some species are specialists in habitats that are extremely abundant, like species that might live in grasslands. But other species, so they have a wide distribution, but other species might be found only in, say, a very unique kind of habitat with certain climate or soil conditions, and that habitat is not very widespread on the planet. Therefore, that species becomes rare.
Now, when a species has a very limited habitat that it can thrive in, is it more possibly open to endangerment by human interaction than species like robins, but I mean, I understand a lot of songbirds that are real generalists are also becoming endangered or are becoming threatened in the United States.
That's true. So a number of breeding bird surveys have shown that a lot of birds have declined, but really that's largely because of loss of habitat. We know that, for example, here in the East, right now in Washington, D.C., I'm looking out and it's 76 degrees and the birds should be back soon, or spring migrants. But the problem they face when they come back here is that the really large blocks of forest habitat that they need, the warblers, the flycatchers, the tanagers, have largely disappeared. And what we have is a lot of habitat fragmentation. And when you have that, a lot of predators can enter and destroy their nests, eat their eggs or eat their nestlings. So it's a severe problem. And the same thing for grassland birds, is that their habitats have become more and more fragmented. So typically, we find that a lot of species One of the biggest threats to their continued existence is land use change. But, as I point out in my book, in the very first chapter, which goes to the island of New Guinea and to a forest that is so remote that no person had ever set foot there, no biologist, no hunter, even in that situation, which is as close to sort of a natural biological Eden as you can get, most of the species are still rare. So it's a natural phenomenon.
And so we shouldn't be upset about that, but it does seem that we have to make sure we don't upset those habitats.
That's right. No, I think that, you know, we know that rarity is a natural phenomenon, but we are certainly accelerating it. Now, most biologists agree that we are in the sixth great extinction spasm in the history of our planet, but the difference is the other five all occurred before human beings ever emerged, and so this one has our fingerprints on it, and we should be doing everything that we can to try to reverse it. And in my book, for each of the chapters where I talk about a different kind of rarity, I also talk about the measures that we're taking to try to make sure that species that have become rare because of human interventions can also recover. And we have some incredibly hopeful stories of that.
Well, I want to talk, actually, I like the way you structured it, where we'll talk next about the endangerment to these species that have very limited habitat by basically the invasive species that enter either with the help of human beings or sometimes on their own, and then move through some of the other kinds of human-induced problems to rare species. And then we can look at some of the solutions. So the place that really stands out, I think, in a lot of people's minds as a place that had a very unique fauna and flora until relatively recently was Hawaii. So let's talk a little bit about the rarities that are endemic to Hawaii and how they have been threatened from the outside.
Sure. Well, Hawaii is a textbook case, and it may be a textbook for what the reason I'll give now is just imagine that if Charles Darwin and Captain Fitzroy had decided not to stop at the Galapagos but left Chile and kept going west and instead landed on the Hawaiian Islands. If that were the case, that students today would be reading about the Hawaiian honey creepers as the example of evolution, or Darwin would have gotten his great insights of evolution by natural selection by looking at the honey creepers rather than the Darwin's finches or the Galapagos finches. There were many, many more species of honey creepers, as many as 51 and only 14 of the Darwin's finches in the Galapagos. And they underwent an incredible radiation, but not just honey creepers, fruit flies, which a lot of people aren't that wild about, but in the wild in Hawaii, instead of a handful of species, there may be as many as 2,000. So unbelievable diversity. The same is true for ferns, for a whole host of plants. Now, these plants, because Hawaii is a volcanic island, it means that everything that got there had to fly or drift over or have its seeds carried somehow. And one of the things about Hawaii was there were no natural predators. The only native mammals on Hawaii is a kind of bat that flew over and the Hawaiian monk seal. So there were no predators there. And then when people had the bright idea of introducing the mongoose as a way of controlling rats that had been brought over by the Polynesians, then basically all ecological hell broke loose, and the mongoose turned out to be terrible predators of nocturnal rats, but because they're diurnal, but wonderful daytime eaters of birds' eggs and nestlings. And so the mongoose were on all but one island, and they wiped out a lot of the bird fauna. So invasives, because a lot of species can evolve without any kind of recognition of predators if they haven't been exposed to any, then they're helpless. And that's one reason why a lot of species went extinct in Hawaii.
Well, I want to back up a little bit because this other fascinating thing you talk about what creates these very unique species or what makes a species differentiate itself from its originator. So let's talk a little about the geography and the topology and maybe the geology that really enhances certain kinds of rarities.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, the Hawaiian archipelago, I mean, probably a lot of your listeners have been to Hawaii, and we'll note that the islands are relatively close together. So the critical issue in biology, in evolution, for species to diverge is isolation. They have to be separated for a long enough period of time and have no mixing for these adaptations to a slightly different environment can accumulate, and then the species diverge. And if they meet again, they don't interbreed, so they're good species, in other words. But for some things that are pretty mobile, like birds, a number of them could move around the Hawaiian Islands, so you didn't get as much differentiation as with, say certain insects. So it all depends on how long individual species have been isolated and how good they are at dispersing, moving around. But so some islands that have been isolated for a long time, like Madagascar or the island of New Caledonia off the coast of Australia or New Zealand, has an incredible unique flora and fauna because they've remained in isolation for so long from the mainland. Other islands, like the Channel Islands off the coast of California, they have been isolated for some time, but they're so close that animals can move back and forth, and so it's the barrier is not as extreme. So it's all about isolation.
Now, Australia is kind of an interesting case because Australia, probably for like a school child, is the most notable example of a very unique fauna. What created the uniqueness of Australia's fauna, and then how did the invasion of other species impact the native fauna of Australia?
Okay, well, so Australia is a great example. It was split off. It was part of the ancient continent of Gondwanaland that broke apart, and Australia was isolated for a very long period of time, and its main connection actually was to New Guinea, and I talk about that in the first chapter of my book. So New Guinea and Australia share a number of weird species, like the birds of paradise. There are a few that are found in northern Australia and the majority of the 40 species found in New Guinea. But you also have wallabies and kangaroos in southern New Guinea, too, because there was a land bridge there across the Torres Straits for a long time, and so there was an exchange. But Australia and New Guinea, that part of the world, has been separated from the mainland of Asia, and so the placental mammals, like ourselves, like dogs, like rats, did not cross that barrier until they were introduced by humans. And so the marsupials, which is kind of a different group of mammals that have a different way of breeding and raising their young, they remain separated. But what was fascinating about Australia is that because of this isolation and this separation, that the mammals of Australia, the marsupials, evolved into all the different niches that we see on mainland Asia. So you had, you know, the Tasmanian tiger and Tasmanian devils, and you had wombats that kind of are like, you know, giant herbivores, and the Tasmanian tigers and devils, the top predators of the island. And then when placental mammals were introduced, they again created ecological havoc by usurping a lot of the native species.
I'm talking this morning with Eric Dinnerstein, who's author of The Kingdom of Rarities, and we're talking about the difference between being rare and being endangered and sometimes how the two intersect. Australia is like one example of isolation that was impacted by probably several successive invasions of both other plants, other animals, and then humans. And I like to compare that with some of there's an island, I think, in Indonesia, maybe New Guinea, areas that are so unique, and you're describing that place where no humans had ever tread. And I want to describe the difference between the kinds of rarities that can thrive in these places that are untouched and what the succession of things that happened both in Australia and Hawaii that had such a detrimental impact on its indigenous wildlife.
Well, certainly, because when Australia was invaded by Europeans, they brought with them a lot of, you know, a lot of species they were familiar with or liked, and so you know, we had a number of these placental mammals that were just much more aggressive and better competitors, and so they pushed out a lot of the marsupials. A lot of birds have been introduced as well, and one of the worst was rabbits that were brought in, and then rabbits were brought in to try to counteract the spread of cacti from cacti. So cactuses are not native to Australia, but they were brought in and they escaped. And so rabbits were brought in as well. And then a virus was brought in to control the rabbits. So it's sort of one thing after another, trying to to regain control again. In Hawaii, it wasn't just the mongoose, but it was also the spread of something that is much less conspicuous, that has really done in so many of the birds. It was the introduction of a kind of mosquito that could carry the vector for malaria, which is a protozoan, for avian malaria. So avian malaria was there in Hawaii before, but it couldn't reach a lot of the areas of Hawaii, especially the upper areas, without any vector to spread it. But when this mosquito was introduced, a particular species that carried it, that wreaked havoc in the bird population, the native bird population of Hawaii, which were not at all adapted to avian malaria. But really, the biodiversity crisis in Hawaii happened over 1,000 years ago when the Polynesians first arrived, and they brought in the pigs and other domestic livestock. But worse was the rats that came probably stowaways on their boats. And it's often thought that the rats, introduced rats, have done more damage to native Hawaiian birds than even the malaria, because they were such voracious predators.
Well, it sort of shows that there's two kinds of ways that we introduce alien species. And it's one thing, and we can wonder, scratch your head, why somebody, you know, introduced starlings to North America or things like that.
Maybe they were pretty.
Right, yeah. I mean, you understand a little bit more the thinking that would introduce pigs, even though it's pretty short-sighted when it comes down to it. But I'm thinking about all the kinds of invasive species that we bring along by mistake. I mean, and now we're having this phenomenon on the West Coast of the United States where we're getting all the tsunami debris from Japan. And, I mean, there was this huge dock that washed up on the beach of Oregon last spring, and it was full of all kinds of freeloaders that had been picked up all the way across the Pacific. And the scientists in Oregon did the best they could to fumigate the dock and to eradicate as many of the invasives as they could. But, it's very hard to control once these things happen. So how much is this due to humans migrating from place to place? And how much of these invasive species do you think come along on their own?
That's a really good question, and I think partly depends on the size of the organism and what we call its life history, so how long it can survive in sort of, let's call it, in transit. So some species can, like bacteria, some insect pests, do very well because they have a phase where they can just become inactive, and then when they reach the right conditions and they land or get moved somewhere, they spring back and start doing their work. For example, I was just in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park just 2 weeks ago in Tennessee, our most visited national park in the United States. And there's a problem. There's an insect called the woolly adelgid that attacks eastern hemlocks. And probably a lot of your listeners know about the blight that wiped out the Chinese chestnut in the eastern U.S. in the 1920s. And so a long time, well, not even that long ago, last century, the forests of the Appalachians were so different when chestnuts were the dominant tree in a vast part of the Appalachians. They disappeared because of the Chinese chestnut blight, a blight brought in from China, a disease. And the forests are recovering. They're different now. And now we're expecting another scourge, the woolly adelgid, that practically kills every eastern hemlock it comes across. And so these are some of the changes that are afoot. The forests won't disappear, but they'll change. And this is happening around the world because of movements of some of these species that are under control in their own environment where they originated, but then they go to a new environment. And for a while, at least, until we find natural predators or natural diseases that attack them, there's an imbalance. And that's when these sort of ecological crises come about.
Well, how much of this invasion is due to human intervention, does any of it just happen on its own without these bacteria and other kinds of life forms basically stowing away on ships or barges or airplanes?
Well, quite a bit does happen because of human activities, but we have to remember that well, if we think of it as invasions in kind of a militaristic way, that most invasions of plants and animals actually fail. Very few of them succeed because they perish along the way, or they arrive and there's not enough of them to breed, or they don't compete very well in the new environment where they land. But every once in a while, they hit the jackpot and do very well. One of the studies that my colleagues and I did is we looked at the distribution of non-native plants in the United States, and you can almost perfectly overlay the concentrations of where non-native plants are found and the major hubs, the major areas of terminals, of harbors, where species came in through ships and then from there disseminated along railroad lines. And it's pretty stark, the comparison of how much overlap there is. And so we can say that there is a dramatic effect. Like, for example, about 36% to 40% of the flora now in a couple of the eastern states are composed of exotic plant species coming from Europe and Asia. So we know that we've had this effect. But like I say, a lot of these invasions, what we see often are the successes, but what we don't see, because we can't record them, are the millions of failures too.
Well, one of the more disturbing sections of your book, you call it the ghosts of Indochina. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about the impact that war has on areas that were renowned for having amazing rare species. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk a little bit about your experiences in Vietnam and Cambodia.
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, one of the amazing things about rarity in Vietnam, and this is something that really was only learned about, I'd say, in the last three decades, just because that area had been engulfed by war and inaccessible to biologists, is once peacetime came around, that the area known as the Annamite Mountains that form a chain that runs along the spine of Vietnam and into neighboring countries, borders neighboring countries, was just an absolute gold mine of rare species. And it was, once again, because we had the same factors operating: long isolation, ancient mountains, variation in climate, a lot of topographic relief, wet valleys bordered by dry valleys and rain shadows bordered by wet valleys again. And so it almost seems like, I sort of joke in the book, that it's like all the rarities of Asia, that the earth tilted and they all rolled towards Vietnam and settled in these little holes in the Annamite range. And, for example, the world's most recently discovered large mammal, the sao la, a kind of forest sort of goat antelope, was only discovered and named in the 80s. And how could a 200-pound mammal exist without scientists discovering it? Well, it was up in the Annamites, and we've discovered hundreds of new species of vertebrates in the last few years just by searching these areas. So it's remarkable that so many of them survived the conflict, but the reason they did is because that most of the forest that remains in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos occurs along the borders, in part because that was the route of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and it was used as a way of hiding the guerrillas when they came down from the north. I once was sitting next to General Ziap, who was the Eisenhower of Vietnam, and in the conflict. And he said at a conference, he became a conservationist, and he said, "The forests were our friends. They hid us, and now we have to protect it." So now they have better reasons for protecting their forests in Vietnam, and they should, because they're full of some of the rarest species on Earth.
Now, we also know in Vietnam that a lot of the forests were defoliated by Agent Orange, because the States recognized that the forest was the friend of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. So I'm wondering, what impact has that had on perhaps dispersing or wiping out a wide range of very rare species?
That's an excellent question and a difficult one to answer. Some of it depends on the number of applications of Agent Orange or some of the other defoliants they used. So, for example, if there was one spraying of Agent Orange, a number of the trees would lose their leaves, but they'd just do it like it would be a defense mechanism if it was a too dry, dry season. And they wouldn't die. they'd just be defoliated for that season. But with repeated applications, then the trees did die. But clearly, a number of trees must have survived, because when I was there in 1990, we saw trees that were certainly, you know, in their hundreds of years old, that would assume that the areas were sprayed, where we were in areas that were sprayed, and they would have been dead if Agent Orange had killed everything. But clearly it was, you know, not uniform, the effects of it. But what we don't know is, you know, in the organisms themselves, I don't think there's been very many studies of how species concentrated the chemicals, because certainly the big problem of that was dioxin, the chemical that we know well of that's a carcinogen and that accumulated in humans, both American GIs and also the Vietnamese themselves, that has led to all sorts of illnesses and diseases that were settled in court in the United States, but really was not addressed in Vietnam. So application of defoliants was an ecological disaster for sure, but we just don't know the extent of it.
I would also wonder what impact it would have had on animals that lived in the forest. You would think that they might have similar reactions, carcinogenic reactions, that humans had.
That's a possibility. You know, a subpopulation of the Javan rhino, now probably the rarest mammal on Earth, there are only about maybe 50 left in the western tip of Java in Ujung Kulon National Park, not far from the volcano Krakatoa. But when biologists were fretting about how few Javan rhinos there were on the western tip of Java, there were actually probably more Javan rhinos in Vietnam and Cambodia than there were in Java before the French Indochina War. But with the war came more poaching, and after the war. But in effect, in some of the areas, because people did not venture into these forests because of the fighting, in some places, war can actually have a momentary reprieve because of these no man's lands that are created. However, the opposite of that is in Cambodia, during the fighting with the Khmer Rouge, is that the soldiers used the wildlife stocked forests as their larder, and they lived off the land, so to speak, and they harvested a lot of the large mammals for food. And so what we're doing now in Cambodia is really rebuilding this magnificent legacy of what was really the Southeast Asian Serengeti, if you will, of a large wild cattle-dominated ecosystem that will hopefully someday have its tigers back in it and more elephants, and will be as great a spectacle in its own way, at least biologically, as Angkor Wat is culturally.
Well, if you just tuned in, we're talking with Eric Dennison, who's author of The Kingdom of Rarities, and we're talking about the rarest species on the Earth and how endangerment affects them, and also how endangerment, human impacts, can also endanger more common species and maybe put them in the same boat as some of the rarities. And we'll get to that in a moment. Just before we get into like looking at species like the California condor, who I think you could say were have been nearly wiped out with a lot due to human activity, I want to talk a bit more about being in this war zone and some of the pressures. You talk about how people are really working to rebuild the ecosystem in Cambodia, but there are other pressures that both in Cambodia and in Vietnam that could probably undo all the great conservation work that's going on. I wonder if you can talk about that.
Well, the biggest problem right now, I would say, in Vietnam and Cambodia is poaching. For example, World Wildlife Fund working with local communities, paid for community user groups to remove snares from a reserve. And I have in my book, in the chapter on Indochina, that they removed several thousand snares in the course of only a few months of activity, of patrolling. So it shows you the dimension of the problem, that for a lot of people, catching wildlife either to eat or, in some cases, for their body parts is a tremendous challenge. It's why the Javan rhinos were wiped out in Vietnam. Right now, the price of rhino horn in Asia has skyrocketed from $30,000 a kilogram, which is still extraordinarily expensive, only 2 years ago, to $100,000 a kilogram. So rhino horn, powdered rhino horn, is more valuable for its weight than gold right now. And so There are other species like that that are not quite as valuable, but tigers are probably worth $60,000 a tiger. So it's tremendous pressure on certain species that are highly valued, largely for mythical, all for mythical purposes. But these are ones that have been removed from these ecosystems because of their value.
Well, I understand there'd be a lot of pressure besides, there's the cultural pressures, and then there's also the economic pressures. I mean, I was in Cambodia a number of years ago, once you could return there, but they still hadn't removed a lot of landmines, and so basically I stayed pretty much in urban areas and got a good image, a good sense of the intense poverty and how hard people were working and still not really, not having a functional government, basically, that would really provide any kind of safety net for a country that was almost driven to the brink of oblivion. So what do we do with the kind of economic pressures in these countries that are driving poaching and also driving illegal logging?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that you'd be amazed at Cambodia today. So it's a thriving country. And interestingly, the distribution of people in Cambodia is that probably half the population lives in and around Phnom Penh. And so when you get out to the what we call the Eastern Plains along the border with Vietnam, it's very, very low population density, about what you'd see if you went to, you know, Montana, Nevada, areas like that. And so it's not a strong population pressure there. And in fact, it's the largest tract of wilderness that's true wilderness that's left in Southeast Asia. In Vietnam, certainly, illegal logging has been a problem, and so Vietnam and Thailand are both looking towards Cambodia and Laos as a way of exploiting the timber resources of those countries. Really, in I would say the biggest issue for Cambodia, and landmines have all been cleared too, so really the issue now is governance, that the same issues that will help Cambodia, I think, accelerate its growth and achieve much better standards of living for its people are the same issues of governance that will help us improve cooperation and conservation of its unique wildlife. And so I think that there's a lot to hope for. Now, in Cambodia, there is the sadness that one of the most spectacular animals that have ever lived, the Cambodian forest ox, called the kuprey, the last one probably died in, somewhere in the 60s or 70s. But for a long time, it was the holy grail of biologists to try and go and find this creature, which had this amazing horns that resembled like Texas longhorns, or I guess you'd call them Cambodian longhorns. But they were in about the most inhospitable place you could imagine. Terrible malaria that was deadly for people who ventured in there if they weren't protected with prophylactics. And warfare for a long period of time, and just hostile indigenous groups that just didn't want anybody roaming around in their areas. And so it was very difficult. And then after that, after the war, the landmines. So it was very difficult to explore and try to find this species. But in the process of trying to look for the kuprey, that's when people found the saola, that forest antelope, and many other species that were new to science. And we realized that eastern Cambodia and also Vietnam had a tremendous amount still to offer for conservation. If we can just get the incentives right and get those governments working more towards conserving the unique heritage and what's globally distinct for their countries, then I think we'll move forward more quickly.
Well, I want to return to this country and to the California condor, which is kind of an icon here in the Pacific Northwest. I think we have a couple in captivity in southern Oregon, and then there's a handful in California. But they were a bird that flew basically to find this region back before first contact with Europeans. So I wonder if you talk a bit about what happened to the California condor and how representative would you say it is for other megafauna that have had a hard time in North America?
Well, I think that the condors are very interesting because they're scavengers, and we see a lot of scavengers around the world that are disappearing. The crisis we think of the California condor here in the U.S., but over in Asia, there are three species of vultures, including the white-rumped and slender-billed and others that have virtually disappeared after being really common. And there it was the use of a drug to address, to treat arthritis in cattle, that when the cattle died and the vultures came to scavenge on the carcasses, they got infected and had kidney failure. And so we see these problems. In the case of the California condor, it was probably ingestion of lead shot, but also loss of habitat. So the California condor, the condors flew over large areas, scavenging, looking for food. And once again, the problem of habitat fragmentation, the loss of habitat and then the breakup into these smaller pieces, simply was not conducive for these animals and their ecology and the way they hunted. But I also think that the California condor is a somewhat unique example to the United States or to developed countries, because people decided, and I think rightfully, that whatever the cost, we were going to restore this amazing creature. And I think they have been successful. What it does do is it raises the question, there are so many rarities out there, and there are some of those rarities that are endangered. Which ones do we focus on? How do we allocate resources if resources are scarce? And it's basically a process that biologists call triage. We have to decide. In many cases, though, the public has a major voice to play and should in this, and they decide, the public decides what species that we absolutely decide cannot go extinct on our watch. And I use the California condor as an example when I talk in other countries about what we need to do, what other countries need to do, and the commitment we need to make sure that species do not go extinct because of human activities.
Well, when I go hiking in the Columbia Gorge and there's amazing pictographs on the rocks there, many which feature the thunderbird, the California condor. And in fact, when I first saw the pictographs, I didn't know that that was an image of the California condor, which was kind of a distant, vague information that I had, not really connected to my life. But now that I understand how much of a role it played throughout this region, and I've talked with Native people who are really excited about reestablishing the condor, I think perhaps that's what we need, is to be finding some way of connecting personally with the amazing animals that used to frequent our areas.
Oh, certainly. And, you know, I'm involved in a project that we started 13 years ago in not too far from Oregon in the state of Montana. And World Wildlife Fund, together with the American Prairie Reserve, is trying to create a reserve that will be twice the size of Yellowstone, that will have the largest American bison herd in the world, and will someday have the top predators there as well. There's also the largest elk herd east of the Rockies, in a spectacular place along the Missouri Breaks. And I came at that project not because I'm a North American conservationist. Quite the opposite, is because most of my work in the 38 years I've been involved in international conservation has been overseas. And there are a lot of people who, in other countries, you know, when we tell them, oh, you really must save your tigers and your elephants and your rhinos, and those who know enough about American history say, well, what happened to your bison and your grizzly bears? You know, why are you lecturing us when you haven't done very much in your own country? And so I think that as Americans and as international conservationists, we often like to go and tell other people what to do. But I think that projects like in the American Prairie Reserve in Montana, that we can do things that become a showcase for, you know, we can say, nothing went extinct here. Things were just diminished. And we can reassemble these landscapes and make them look like what they did, you know, perhaps in some places when Lewis and Clark went through these areas, of what they experience in the Missouri Breaks, and that's our goal.
Well, thanks very much for being with us, Eric. I'm just thinking about how I have a whole other conversation I'd like to have with you sometime, maybe about some other mass extinctions. Is that an area that you are familiar with?
Yes, I'd be happy to, but so, let's work really hard between now and then on preventing this sixth extinction and do all we can.
Okay, it sounds great. So we will have you back sometime in the next few months, and we'll talk about the other five extinctions.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks a whole lot. We've been talking with Eric Dinnerstein, who is author of The Kingdom of Rarities, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm. Click in the search bar in the upper right-hand corner, put in Locus Focus and today's date, and you'll be able to hear the show or download it. Next week, author Andrew Nikiforuk is going to be returning to Locus Focus to talk about his latest book, The Energy of Slaves. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Kathleen Stevenson. We're going to go out with some music by Abby Lincoln. Thanks for listening.
Bird alone, flying high, flying through a clouded sky, sending mournful, soulful sounds, soaring over troubled grounds. Bird alone, with no mate, turning corners, tempting fate. Flying circles in the air. Are you on your way somewhere? Gliding, soaring on the wind. You're a sight of glory. Flying way up there so high, wonder what's your story. Bird alone, flying low over where the grass is. Swinging low, then out of sight, you'll be singing in the night.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Women are often told that weight gain, sleeplessness, diminished sex drive, hair loss, fatigue, and depression are unavoidable parts of getting older, that sleeping pills, hormone replacement therapy, and antidepressants are the only answer. Today's guest, Dr. Sarah Gottfried, an MIT and Harvard-trained physician, board-certified gynecologist, and nationally recognized yoga teacher, disagrees. Gottfried has developed a protocol to help women take control of their hormones, primarily using therapies that do not require a prescription and which have been supported by the best scientific evidence. She's here today on Health Watch to talk about this and her new book, The Hormone Cure: Reclaim Balance, Sleep, Sex Drive, and Vitality Naturally with the Gottfried Protocol. Welcome to Health Watch, Dr. Sarah Gottfried.
Thank you, Dr. Naiman. So happy to be with you.
So there's a lot of research now that women, when they go to the doctor, more often have their symptoms dismissed than men. And you mentioned some here, that it's not normal to feel fatigued, anxious, and irritable, say, in middle age. But often, I would guess, a woman going with those symptoms is going to be taken perhaps less seriously than a man. Can you talk a little bit about why it's not normal to be having those symptoms?
Sure. You know, I really believe that we're facing an epidemic of hormone imbalance. Most folks have a hormone imbalance and don't know it, and this applies to both men and women. But I think with a number of different factors, what's happened is that as women face these problems especially, and we know that women are much more likely to be anxious, depressed, have trouble sleeping. In fact, they have about double the rate of insomnia as men do. They have more autoimmune conditions. They struggle with pregnancy and kind of the aftermath of pregnancy. When they have those issues, I think they often get dismissed or told something like, you're just stressed, or you're just getting older. And it's not just middle age, David. It's also women who are in their 20s and their 30s. You know, maybe women who are starting to face those early symptoms of perimenopause, you know, where your ovaries start to run out of ripe eggs around 35. So this applies across many different ages, and I want to turn that around. I want to change the conversation we're having about hormones, because the truth is, if you figure out the reason why you feel fat, cranky, don't want to have sex, or maybe feel overwhelmed, if you go to the root cause, you're going to have a sustained benefit. You're not going to be craving the wine or hearing jungle drums if you don't stick chocolate in your mouth. You're going to feel so much better when you take charge of your health hormones and happiness.
And I would imagine if somebody goes to the doctor saying they're feeling fatigued and they leave with a prescription without a lot of questions asked, that the root cause hasn't really been looked for yet.
You got it. I mean, I love your background as well, David, and I think you and I are probably on a similar page about this. What I find is that the people who come to see me who have fatigue or maybe have some mild depression, or they just feel like they're pushing a rock up a hill and they wish it weren't the case, when they see their local physician, often they get offered an antidepressant or maybe the latest anxiety medication or sleeping pill if they're having trouble with disrupted sleep or they can't wind down at night. And I would say that's exactly the wrong treatment. You know, if we just take depression for a moment, we know that 50% of people with depression have high cortisol levels. You know, that's the lovely stress hormone that we want to have in the Goldilocks position of not too high, not too low. And 20% of them have low thyroid function. So I think there's a certain number of hormones that we really want to pay attention to and get into that sweet spot of not too high, not too low.
Well, before we talk about some of these individual hormones, can we talk a little bit more about why women are more vulnerable to these imbalances? You say men are vulnerable too, but you mentioned women having much more anxiety, having more sleep problems, having more autoimmune diseases. I know they have way more thyroid problems than men. What is the reason, or do we know the reason, why women suffer so much more from hormone imbalances causing these symptoms?
There's a number of factors. You know, some of them I think are well proven. I don't think we have the full story yet on why exactly women are more vulnerable. But some of the headlines here are, number one, women get pregnant, right?